This is the news podcast from Israel Next, the podcast for an inspired and credible Israel engagement. Hua Sørensen, behind the microphone, this is Inside Out, giving you the Israeli perspectives on the news, and today is May 19th. So, we will today talk about the following things. The Jerusalem Day. Tens of thousands of Israelis rejoice over the unification of Jerusalem, 56th year since the unification of this wonderful city that I had the privilege of living in for 8 years. Tens of thousands rejoice over it, but not everyone are happy with this celebration. We will talk about Netanyahu's struggles with his coalition in the budget crisis or in the budget negotiations that are ongoing right now. But just to get to the finishing line, I think he will make it even this time. Then Mahmoud Abbas becomes even more extreme as more and more nations are pushed off by his rhetoric. He this week spoke in the UN. And an inscribed curse found on in an archaeological excavation at Mount Ebal causes controversy among archaeologists. Finally, this week's Torah portion deals with the significance of the silence of the desert and also deals with numbers. So, first things first, we go to the Jerusalem Day. It's been, I had the joy to participate in this Jerusalem Day for several times, and it's a really huge celebration, and you can understand why. Jerusalem then being the capital of Israel, the King David associated with him, and you know, this wonderful history, and with the deep roots connecting to the greatness and the time of Israel, and also, of course, to the God of Israel, who chose Jerusalem and who chose Zion and the temples that were standing there. And then for 2,000 years being thrown out of the city, being allowed in now and then and so on, being not allowed for certain periods, but then again having it back, having it unified 56 years ago in 1967. That's really something that is worth celebrating. And there is no other people on earth that has so strong ties to this city as the Jews. There are definitely other people that have ties. I myself consider having ties there, but not as strong as this Jewish tradition going back thousands of years. So anyway, this is an annual event taking place, and there have been controversy around it the last few years. I mean, there have been for some time, but it used to be a more broad consensus about the celebration in Israel. It has become more politicized the last few years or the last decade. Also now the terror organization want to have a say in what's going on during that day. And of course, it would be a huge mistake to allow them to have a say, even if Netanyahu did that a couple of years ago when he changed the course of the march, this parade that goes through the city. This time, they kept the original plan, and that parade, it starts in downtown western part of Jerusalem, King George Street. And then it goes down Agron Street towards the Jaffa Gate, where it splits in two parts. So one part of the parade goes through the Jaffa Gate, and the other part goes around on the outside of the walls and in through the Damascus Gate, which is the more controversial part. Because the Damascus Gate is where many terror attacks have taken place, and this is like main center of the terror groups and where they really try to hit, because there's also a lot of Jews going in and out that gate since it is close to the ultra-Orthodox areas. So anyway, there were 3,500 police officers and volunteers that were called up to guard the city, and especially also because there had been a lot of threats from terrorists and terrorist groups. But the big focus is, of course, on the tens of thousands of people that come from all over the country. Many of them are settlers, and they come to celebrate the unification of Jerusalem. Now, the thing is that before this march could start, of course, the participants had to arrive in the city. And left-wing groups, they blocked the roads, especially from Gush Etzion, which is just south of Jerusalem, outside Bethlehem. But it's a huge cluster of settlements out there and Jewish communities. And many would come in from there in busloads and to participate in this march. And so they have to go through this tunnel road. And there at this road, the left-wing protesters, they sat down on the road and they linked themselves together. And police had quite a job to get them away there. So anyway, they were saying that they wanted to prevent the participants from reaching the March of Hate, as they call it, the March of Hate. And they accused the entire event of being racist and apartheid. And I'm just shocked about this because there are fringe elements, and we will come to them, that are racist in this march. But the huge, huge majority, 99% of the people, they are there really to celebrate something that is so worth celebrating. And the fact that you get, and that the media also get caught up in the few extremists, that is sad. I will get back to that in a minute. But before the march started, Prime Minister Netanyahu spoke also at the ceremony at Ammunition Hill, and he said the following: "Despite the threats, and I will tell you because of the threats, I instructed to hold a flag march with the participation of thousands on its traditional route, as usual and according to procedure. We dealt heavy blows to our aggressors in the Gaza Strip, and I believe that the message was received not only by them, but also in other places in our region, who witnessed the impressive operational capabilities of the State of Israel. If another reminder is required to renew the deterrence, it will also come. We changed the equation." So he, of course, is referring here to the operation that took place last week against Islamic Jihad in Gaza Strip, where Israel really had a good success in taking out the terrorist leaders. He was very firm here in his statements, as he usually is. He speaks very hard and doesn't always follow up with action. This time, during the operation in Gaza, there was also action. But then we also had the opposite side of the political specter, a member of the Knesset from Hadash Tal, which is really an Arab party, but he himself is Jewish. His name is Ofer Kassif, and I've mentioned him previously on this podcast, but because he makes a lot of statements that are just outrageous. So also this time. And he said the following: "The March of Hate in occupied East Jerusalem is no different from the marches of neo-Nazis in the USA or fascists in Europe. Flag dancers, racist terrorist demonstrators." So that's his commentary on this. And then, of course, also we had at the Gaza border, we had Palestinian Arabs that were demonstrating along the border fence, burning tires, waving with the Palestinian flags and putting them on the, climbing on the fence and hanging their flags on the fence, and also throwing explosives towards the fence. So that went on down there. Then when we come to this, that the media usually is busy with describing the scuffles and the controversy surrounding this march. So at the Damascus Gate, there were a lot of Arab youth, and they had also said this before. They were interviewed on Israeli television before that they would they aimed at provoking and creating trouble, attacking the demonstrators, and they were threatening them before the march started. So there were Arab youth hurling insults and threatening the participants, and it's hard to get a full picture here if they also attacked the participants, but that what we see at least is that there is a response from the Jewish, some of the Jewish participants. And so we have this scuffle going on, and people are being beaten and falling to the ground. At least in one instance, there are a bunch of Jews surrounding an Arab and beating him. So that, of course, has caused a lot of controversy. And the U.S. even has come out and condemned the outrageous and unacceptable violence and racist behavior at the flag march. So the reactions here come very quickly when there are Jews that are involved, and not so quickly when it goes the other way. But of course, this is not acceptable from the organizers of this flag march. They need to be able to control these things. There is especially one organization called the Lehava that I would also characterize as at least some of those members being there are really racist in their commentaries and their actions. So that is a very problematic organization that is very prominent. Prominent, they are very few, but they are very visible during this march. So the members of this organization and what they represent, that needs to be rooted out of this demonstration if it is again to gather a broad national consensus. So I really hope that the organizers and the Jews in general that participate in this will make sure that these things are not repeated, that it's not accepted. But in this, and especially between Lehava demonstrators and journalists, because there were also scuffling going on between Jewish journalists and these Lehava demonstrators. Of course, the journalists are not very positive to anything on the right side of Israeli politics. But so there was scuffling between these, and one journalist was also arrested because they were throwing water bottles and stuff at each other. So it's sad that these things receive the headline, because it's really about something else. It's about huge miracle, really. You could describe it as a miracle after 2,000 years coming back to their own capital. That is unheard of. So that is what it is, like this huge thing to celebrate, and that these small minor things, they get the headlines. But that's the nature of journalism. Good news are seldom newsworthy, but violence is. So when it comes to the end, at the end of this march, of course, they split up in two parts. One go through the Jaffa Gate and one go through the Damascus Gate, but they both end up at the Western Wall, where there is like a huge manifestation and joy going on. And also some of them go up to the Temple Mount. Then there was member of the Knesset from Likud. He also went up and he said, it's not my first time here and I'm always excited to go up to the mount. It is inconceivable to accept the claim as if the presence of Jews in a certain place, especially in the holiest place for the people of Israel, is an extreme act. As someone who immigrated to Israel from abroad, to the state of the Jews, out of deep Zionism, I cannot accept an argument that says that the very presence of Jews in a certain place is a provocation. This is unacceptable. So that is a view that I completely agree with. But against that, you had one of his party colleagues, also from the Likud party, Dudi Amsalem, and he said, we hear that MKs, members of Knesset, ascend the Temple Mount. This is not what should be done. And he said, especially in this time when it's so tense. Let's see if I have that quote. Well, I don't have that quote, but he also added this. And also ultra-Orthodox members of Knesset, they also condemned the visits by Knesset members or the visits on the Temple Mount in general. And they said it can cause diplomatic trouble and it desecrates this holy site. So for them, of course, this is a matter of principle. They don't want anyone, any Jew, to visit the Temple Mount because it desecrates the place, according to their view. So The question then is, if not on this day, like Dudi Amsalem says, that you can go up there at any other time, why right now when it is so tense? But I would say, if you cannot go up there on this day that marks the unification of Jerusalem, when can you go up? And if it is the tensity, the tense situation, the threats by the terrorists that prevent you, then you can be rest assured that next time anyone goes up, whether it be on Monday or Tuesday or Friday or whatever day it be, whether it be in January or in March or in whenever, they will always threaten. If they see that this works, they will always make the situation tense. And in the end, you will be limited, completely limited. So you have to make a statement. I completely disagree. Of course, you realize that there is a big picture, there are security threats, there are security assessments and so on, and we don't know everything. But if you pull back, you will forever pull back. You have to step forward, and you have to, this is how power dynamics in the Middle East works. And I know it's hard for a Westerner to accept this, but the mentality in the Middle East is different. And their power rules and power speaks, and you have to be assertive. So I agree with this MK Danilus that says, I cannot accept an argument that says that the very presence of Jews in a certain place is a provocation, and especially not on their most holy site. So That's it about the Jerusalem Day, the Jerusalem celebration, and there should have been much more about all the joy that goes on, because it's really something that is so fun to be a part of. All these flags and dancings and parades and songs, it's a huge celebration, really. So not dissimilar to what we recently had here 2 days ago, 17th of May, 17th of May, the Norwegian Day of Independence. It's pretty similar, at least parts of it. So we come to the coalition trouble of Benjamin Netanyahu. And, he has a coalition, and that means trouble. Now, the thing here is that what really sets the stage for this trouble is that the coalition agreements were so generous. Yariv Levin, who is now heading the reform of the justice system, he's the one that also negotiated these agreements, and they were giving out money and promising money, budget allocations to all the different parties like never before. I've never seen such a thing. An irresponsible way of making agreements. And now Netanyahu has to answer for this. And so the demands from the different parties are up in the skies. And also, of course, the fact that the finance minister comes from the National Religious Party, and he makes sure that, at least in the eyes of the other parties, he makes sure that his party's wishes and his party's priorities are cared for, but less so the other parties. So that, of course, also creates tension internally. So there have been threats from especially Itamar Ben-Gvir, who is the far-right party. And so he demands money both for settlements, but especially for development and security in the Negev and in the Galilee, which is his responsibility and which is and has to be a national priority, because things are just getting out of hand there when it comes to security in these areas. So he has been demanding and has been very verbal in his demand for more money, and also for he has also refused to vote with the coalition at certain issues. And now we get the same from the Agudat Israel party, one of the ultra-Orthodox parties, and the party leader there is Goldknopf. And he says that unless we get an addition of 600 million shekels for our schools, the yeshivot, and also their elementary school system, then we will vote against the budget. Now, if the budget doesn't pass, that means that the government coalition breaks up. There will be probably new elections in that case, but that is the case. The coalition will then break up if the budget doesn't pass. The government will fall. Now, I don't think that is a big threat or a big danger, because the parties that are in the coalition, they realize that there are no better alternatives. Everything else is worse. So at least for the smaller parties, for the Likud party, especially for Netanyahu, I think he could see a better scenario. He would be very happy to exchange the two right-wing parties, National Religious Party and Otzma Yehudit, with the party of Benny Gantz. So if he can see a way to do that, I'm sure he would. But I don't think there is any opening from that right now. So chances are that the coalition will come to an agreement and the government will survive. Then we have the leader of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, that has been to New York again and to the UN. And, well, the UN and Israel, that is a complicated story. And, of course, even more so when Mahmoud Abbas gets to set the tone. Because in November last year, I think it was, if I remember correctly, on the 29th of November, like the day when the UN voted for the establishment of a Jewish and an Arab state in 1947. Last year, the UN said that they want to mark the 15th of May as the Nakba Day, the day of catastrophe, meaning in sympathy with the Palestinian Arabs that claim that this establishment of Israel was a disaster. Nakba means disaster or catastrophe. And you can say, I mean, you could agree with that, that for Palestinian Arabs, it might have been a disaster, at least for some of them. But who is to blame for that? That is the big question, and it's not Israel. I can say that. But of course, Israel is blamed for that. But it was a disaster for those that had to flee their homes and so on. So, and there were hundreds of thousands of them. So of course, for them, this was terrible. The same happened, of course, for Jews in Arab countries. They also had to flee their homes in the course of months and years that followed. But anyway, so because of that decision in November last year, then to today, or the 15th of May, this Nakba Day was marked at the UN for the first time. And we then have Mahmoud Abbas holding a speech for an hour, more than an hour. He was given half an hour, but he continued. And of course, it is the same old, and even perhaps more extreme in some senses. But I'll just take a few quotes here. And he speaks about Britain and the United States that specifically bear a political and ethical responsibility for the Nakba of the Palestinian people, because they took part in rendering our people a victim when they decided to establish and plant another entity in our historic homeland for their own colonial goals. These countries wanted to get rid of their Jews and benefit from their presence in Palestine. So this is the old accusation that this is a colonial entity, this is a colonial project, the Jews returning to their homeland, the homeland of their ancestors, and that were there way before the Arabs came at all. Way before the Arabs came and took control of that area, and there was a Jewish state, a Jewish capital, and so on and so forth. And there were Jewish temples. So to say that they are a colonial state is just like disconnected from historical facts. And also, if you look at it, how colonial states operate and operated 100 years ago, 150 years ago, they sent small groups of their own people to a certain country. They became the rulers of the country, and they used the local inhabitants to develop, to build, to extract resources, and to send back resources to the home country. And of course, the opposite happens when Jews come to Eretz Israel. It's completely underdeveloped land with very few resources, and the Jews build up the land. They don't even ask anyone else to do it for them. They do it, and all the investment that they make is left in the land. So they turn this land that was a desert into a Garden of Eden. And that is the next claim that Mahmud Abbas is trying to oppose here. Because he says that the Israeli and Zionist claims continue by saying that Israel made the desert bloom. As if Palestine was a desert and they made the desert bloom. These are lies. They continue to lie like Goebbels. And they continue to lie until people believe their lies. And then he continues. Palestinians have lived in the area for thousands of years. Palestine was one of the most civilized lands in the Arab region, with a vibrant culture, libraries, newspapers, printing houses, many agricultural exports, green land, lakes and rivers. Well, I don't know at all when he is talking about. It would be very interesting to hear from him exactly. Give me the year that you're describing here. Because it is true that it was one of the most civilized lands in the Arab region at a certain point. And that point was back in when the Jews had a state there, and it was when during the antique, 2,000 years ago, the Romans developed the country and so on. But then it basically fell into disuse and neglect after the Arabs took over. There was a period when they also built there, and they built like in certain cities, but not all over the country. But then came the Ottomans, and more after a while there, it fell into disuse and neglect. So when the Jews come in the 1800s, I mean, there are always Jews in the land, but when they come back in from Europe and so on, then they start to rebuild a land that is a desert and that is a marshland and there's sand dunes, and they really have to work to get it to become what it is today. So yes, Israel has turned this desert and this marshland into a Garden of Eden. the country, then one more quote, and that is that despite more than 1,000 resolutions adopted on this issue since 1947 by the United Nations General Assembly, the Security Council and Human Rights Council, not a single one has been implemented. That's what he claim he made, and I can tell you that some of them have been implemented, but this says much more about the UN. I haven't checked this number of more than 1,000 resolutions, but that is very likely because there are really hundreds almost every year, but at least tens every year. But the fact that there are so many resolutions against this tiny little nation, as I said, it says everything about the United Nations and their bias towards Israel, and it says nothing about realities on the ground. So the fact that Mahmoud Abbas just continues to make these claims, and in spite of the fact that more and more nations now react to these extreme demands and extreme exaggerations, and that more and more nations now refuse to support this in the UN. And more nations also pull back support, financial support for school books and stuff like this. It doesn't seem to send a message to Mahmoud Abbas, and he continues to be as extreme as he has ever been and to spread these lies. So anyway, one sees that some nations are waking up, and one can only hope that at least a hope that journalists could also wake up to the truth and to see a broader picture than what they present to the people. And I really believe that it will be a shame. It will be shameful for them when the truth is finally revealed. And you see how bad their journalism has been, how twisted an image they have given. So we can only hope that that will happen. That takes us to archaeology, and we haven't had archaeology for a while, but this was pretty interesting, that on Mount Ebal, or Mount Ebal, which is located next to Nablus, the biblical town of Shechem, there was an archaeological excavation that was led by Adam Sertal, the archaeologist, Israeli archaeologist, in the 1980s. Adam Sertal died in 2015, but back then he was leading this excavation, and he found what he believed to be Joshua's altar. Not everybody agrees, that's the way of archaeology, but there are huge arguments that can be made for that. And as with all excavations, you dig away material. Dirt and soil and stuff, and you just put it into dumps. And you try to sift it first, and you do what the best you can to find whatever is there. But then you dump it. And so there were two big dumps that were left by Sertal. And in 2019, they started sifting this with water because that gives much better result. They have used that technique from the material that were thrown out from the Temple Mount. So in that process, they found in 2019, they found a folded lead tablet, folded. So it was, they didn't really know what it was. It's just two times 2 centimeters, so it's quite small, and even then folded. But they saw that there were markings on the outside, and they started interpreting this, and they found out these were letters. And then they also realized that on the inside there were letters. So they couldn't open it because it was too sensitive to do that. So what they did, by use of X-ray and stuff, they have been able to recreate what is written on the inside. And now, in 2022, March 2022, they came with the result of what they had found. And now, this month, peer review of what they found came out. Because, in scientific circles, you can have a scientist coming out with something and it needs to be tested by peers, by others. And they also need to come to the same conclusion in order for this to have some credibility. Now, what they claim to have found, the archaeologist that have been excavating there, and his name, the lead excavator, is Scott Stripling, and they claim to have found written in ancient Hebrew and dating to the 13th century. Some push it back even more, but at least the 13th century. That there are 40 letters of a text, and it says the following, according to Scott Stripling: "Cursed, cursed, cursed by Yud Hey Vav." The name of God is Yud Hey Vav Hey, but this is also a shortened form of it, Yahu, and cursed by Yahu, Yahweh. "You will die cursed, cursed you will surely die. Cursed by Yahweh," or Yahu, "cursed, cursed, cursed." So this is the text. Now, those of you who know the biblical story know that it's written first in Deuteronomy and then in Joshua. But in Deuteronomy, it's written what Israel should do when they come into the land. And in Joshua, it's written what they did. And the thing is that they should place half of the tribes of the Mount Ebal and half on the tribes of Mount Gerizim. And these are two mountains that are located just north and south of Nablus, the city center of Nablus. And the foot of these mountains is very close. It's just a couple of hundred meters between them. So you can really scream from the one side to the other. And so on one side, there should stand 6 tribes of Israel and proclaim the curses. And that would be on Mount Ebal. And on the Mount Gerizim, there should be standing the other 6 tribes, and they should pronounce the blessing. So Israel could choose, like it comes up several times in the Torah, in the Pentateuch. So anyway, that Mount Ebal, where this was found, was the mountain of curse. And here they found this curse inscription. And on the material that was left after excavating the altar of Joshua. So there are many things that fall into place here. And this, of course, creates a lot of controversy among archaeologists, because if this is true, there are some archaeologists that need to reevaluate and maybe change their entire outlook on history if this really is what is written on the tablet, and if it is and can be dated to this time period, because then it will push Hebrew writing, it's a very early form of Hebrew writing, back with several hundred years. And it will say that, first of all, the Israelites who came into the land, they were literate. They could have written the Torah. It will also speak about the name Yahweh or Yahu, that it was much earlier than people have thought, or some scholars have thought. And so there are many things that they would have to reevaluate. But some of the archaeologists see no inscription at all. And some are just irritated by the way it has been published, because they didn't really follow the proper channels when they published this. And there were reasons for that. But anyway, the controversy, as I said, is normal, for it would ruin the lifetime of convictions if this is true then. So Stripling then, he agrees that the inscription can be discussed and the content of it. But Peter van der Ven, who is epigraphist, he's like looking at ancient scripts and able to interpret it and to read what it says. He says that he is confident concerning the main content of the inscription. He says there are some letters that are very hard to identify, but the ones that you can identify, they give you this text, at least the main content of this text. And he would say, he says like this, I would argue, like to see somebody argue, giving me an alternative text based on the letters that are very clear. So he is pretty confident that this is what they can say, although he was also arguing with this other lead excavator, Scott Stripling. So they had their disagreements, but anyway, so it's just interesting to see, because if this is true and if this is correct, so to say, then it really strengthens also the theory that this altar found on Mount Ebal is from the time of Joshua, built by Joshua. So very interesting find. It will be interesting to follow the discussion among scholars here. We have arrived at the weekly Torah portion, Parashat HaShavua, which this time is called simply Bamidbar, which is the name of the fourth book in the Bible, in English, Numbers, the Book of Numbers, and in Hebrew, the Book of Bamidbar, meaning in the desert or in the wilderness. This portion goes from Numbers 1:1 to 4:20. And the summary of what is going on here is that God tells Moses to take a census of the tribes of Israel. He shall do so together with a representative of each tribe. Every male from 20 years and above is to be counted, and everyone who is capable of going to war. I mean, that is the definition. Everyone that is older than 20 years can go to war. The tribe of Levi should be excluded, and the tribe of Joseph is counted as two tribes through Ephraim and Manasseh. So ultimately they end up on 12. The total number is 603,550 persons that are counted. And we're talking about males above the age of 20. The tribe of Levi shall not be counted among them, as they shall take care of the tabernacle. Then the tribes are divided into groups of three and placed in the four geographical directions around the tabernacle. And the Levites, they shall dwell in the inner circle closest to the tabernacle. The sons of Aaron, then, the priests, are listed, and the Levites are given to serve the priests. God says that the Levites are his instead of the firstborn of Israel. Then the Levites are counted according to their families, every male from a month old, and their work tasks are listed. And they end up on being exactly 22,000. And then the firstborn of Israel's tribes are listed, and they are 22,273. They are counted, the firstborn of Israel's tribes. So we count the Levites, and then we count the firstborn of the tribes of Israel. And so they are 22,273. And God says that the Israelites shall pay 5 shekel to redeem the 273 that are more than the Levites. We saw the Levites were 22,000, the firstborn 22,273. So for each of these 273, they should be given money. And these money are to go to the priests. Then finally, and that is of course to redeem them. Finally, the duties of the sons of Kohath are listed, and they are to prepare all the most holy items in the tabernacle before each move. So they have to cover all these items and carry them, or at least cover them, and then the Levites will carry them. Then Aaron and his sons shall appoint the family here of Kohath for this task so that they will not die, because they are touching and they are like looking at the holiest items inside the tabernacle. So the priest, they have to appoint them for that specific task so that they will not die. But Aaron and his sons, the priests themselves, are not allowed to look upon when the family of Kohath, sons of Kohath, are doing their work, lest they will die. So we see there is a danger for everyone here that are involved in dealing with the holy materials inside the tabernacle items. Okay, that's the summary. And then rabbinic commentary speaks about, is it enough just to exist? And his conclusion is no. You don't count if you just exist. You have to contribute. That's the conclusion that he comes to. Because Moses is commanded to take this census of the people. And in Exodus 30, he has already been given orders as to how a census shall happen. And that is that everyone that is counted shall give 0.5 shekel to the tabernacle as a ransom for himself. You know, there is this sensitive thing about counting the people in the Bible, in the Old Testament. And you see, David counts the people and it leads to a plague coming upon them because he did it in the wrong way. Here, of course, it's God that gives the commandment. But it should be done in this way so that each one of them should pay 0.5 shekel. So there is a chance here that we are talking about the same census as in Exodus. But we'll come back to that. Anyway, based on this verse that everyone that is counted must give 0.5 shekel, and then you count the shekels, you don't really count the people. So rabbinic commentator says, it's not enough to exist in order to be counted. It matters what you do, what you contribute. That's when you're counted. So that's an interesting thought. And so the question is that also a New Testament message? Is it a biblical message in total? Well, the New Testament, and I would say the entire Bible, speaks about two stages when it comes to God's relationship to men. And God's love to mankind is unconditional. I mean, you count because you exist. Because you are created in the image of God, you count anyway. God loves you because you exist. And the price that was paid for you, for your salvation, had nothing to do that you deserved it. It was paid even if you had your back turned on God or you're walking away from Him, denying Him. So that love will never cease. You always count. I would claim this is not only the New Testament message, but also the biblical message. You always count. We have this in the Old Testament as well, that you went all astray like sheep, but God let the punishment hit him. We have this in Isaiah 53. So in spite of you not doing, not contributing, but on the contrary, going away, still, God loves you. So that is the one stage of God's relationship to mankind. But then there is the other side. Once you know God, your actions count. Like Jesus said, if you love me, you keep my commandments. If you have a relationship to me, you will act accordingly. So that an intimate relationship with God is dependent on you contributing to it. A relationship cannot be just one-sided. If you want like a proper relationship, you also have to give something in return. So in that sense, there is truth. You have to contribute to count. The thing is that the rabbis, they, perhaps without being aware of it, but they speak on the basis of being in an unbreakable covenant with God. I guess they are aware of that, but because a covenant has been established between Israel and God through Abraham, and that is an eternal covenant. And because of that, there is already a relationship. And based on that, based on the fact that the people of Israel is supposed to know God, then your actions count. It matters what you contribute. So I would say that's the second stage. Once you have gotten to know God, you can no longer continue living the way you lived before. Your actions count. Okay, that was just like an interesting commentary there by a rabbi and my comment on that. An interesting note here is that the census in Exodus 30, and the final numbers of that counting then is recorded in Exodus 38, verse 25 and 26. But there is a census in Exodus, the book of Exodus, 30, 38. And there is a census here in Numbers 1. And the thing is that both of these censuses end up with the exact same number, 603,550. Well, according to the rabbis, and I haven't checked this as far as I can, but there are 7 months apart in time between these two censuses, countings. There's 7 months between them. And of course, people would have been born, people would have died, people would have turned 20, if you count them from the year 20, and so on. So it's interesting. But one of the answers, and I think maybe the best answer, is that it takes a lot of time. It took a lot of time back then to count the people, because if we talk about these families, then 600,000, we don't have the computers, we don't have this kind of system, and we have in total 3 million people. But anyway, it took time to count them, and so that these 6-7 months, they're really the time that is needed to be sure of the number. That is at least one interpretation, and there's much more to argue for that. But that is one option. There could be also two different countings, but the exact same number is very interesting. But the difference between them, and the reason that they are mentioned twice, according to rabbinic commentators, is that the first time they are counted, I mean, they're counted once, but the first time it is told is that it has to do with collecting money for building the tabernacle. That's why you tell it in Exodus. Then you retell the story about the same counting in Numbers, because now it has to do with preparing for war. How many are prepared to go and take the land? Because at this stage, in Numbers 1, they don't know that they're going to wander 40 years in the desert. They are on their way to take the promised land. So they are counting the people for war. So that's the reason given here then, that they tell the story about this counting twice. Okay, the secret of the desert. So this parasha, then Torah portion, and the book itself is called Bamidbar, meaning in the desert, in the wilderness. It's the same word for desert and wilderness. And God's relationship with Israel as a nation starts in the desert. That's interesting. This is where Israel, this group of people, become a nation. God has already said he's going to make them, but now you can say they become a nation under a law, under a system. And the Bible describes, it returns very often to when you were in the desert. When Israel was in the desert, there was like an intimate relationship between God and Israel. And the Bible describes it in, for instance, Hosea 2, Jeremiah 2, Song of Songs 8, describes this as like a love relationship. That's where the relationship was intimate, and you loved me and I loved you and so on. So a good time to get to know God. But what is interesting is that contrary to other peoples at that time and also later, the Jews and the Israelites, they did not worship what could be seen. The other peoples, they worshiped what they could see, the sun, the moon, stones, trees, and idols that they cut for themselves. Israel had a book. They had words. That's kind of not what they worshiped, but that's what gave them their relationship to God, words. And therefore, we also have the most important mitzvah, commandment for the Jews is Shema Israel, hear, O Israel. It's not Re'u Israel, see Israel. Shema Israel. And that takes us to the word Midbar, which I said means desert, wilderness. But the root of that word is Dalet Bet Resh, Davar, which is the word word. Davar means word. And the fact is that Israel was a nation before they had a land. They only had a word. They had a law. They had davar. They heard and they acted. That was enough for them to become a people. They didn't have a land. They didn't have a geography. Usually people become, first they have a geography, a land, and then they, within that territory they develop laws and stuff like this. But with Israel, it's the opposite. They first have a law, and then they get a land. But that word that that they received then in the desert, that is what kept them together as a people. And when they were again thrown out of their land, year 70, the destruction of the temple, and for 2,000 years, they were again able to remain as a people because they united around the word. So when you take that is into New Testament context, and you see in John chapter 1 that in the beginning was the word, and the word was with God, and the word was God. He was in the beginning with God, and he tabernacled among us. So Jesus is presented as the word. So of course here you can really continue to think and get a lot out of that. But the interesting thing, or another interesting thing here, is that monks and Christians as well, when they wanted to seek God, they went to the desert. The first monasteries, the first monks to begin with, started out in the deserts. They went out in the desert to hear from God. Then the first monasteries were built out there in the desert, because it's only in that silence of the desert that you can hear God. It's not only, but that helps, because you need to silence other words so that his word can be heard. So interesting stuff here with the name of the book and the connections here with Midbar, desert, and the word. So that's it for today. And if you like what you hear, please feel free to spread it to your friends, and so that we can reach even further. And also feel free to support the work with prayers and with finances. So if you want to support with finances, you can find Israel Next on Vips, or you can go to our website israelnext.com. and there's a give button there. So that's basically it, and we will, as always, finish with the priestly blessing. Yavarechecha Adonai v'yishmerecha. Ya'er Adonai panav elecha v'yechonecha. Yesa Adonai panav elecha v'yasem lecha shalom. Amen. So thank you so much for listening, and until next time, say something good about Israel.